My wife and children are real pleased to make the trip and be up here. One thing Derek doesn't understand, we went down to Kennewick together this morning. He doesn't understand why we drove 800 miles and we were still 150 miles from church. He doesn't know why we were on the way down there. We drove all this distance and he's still having to drive to Kennewick for church. But I tried to explain it to him. Sabbath School prepared a kind of a welcome book for Megan and Derek. They appreciated that very much. I sure thank you. Both Megan and Derek are looking forward to meeting some friends and having some friends. We were in the restaurant last night. Yesterday was Derek's birthday. Derek is now six. And we said, well, Derek, what do you want to do? He says, I want to go to Golden Corral. Golden Corral is a restaurant they had in Lubbock, so it was something he recognized. He felt like something he could. And we went in, and they were kind of scouting the area, and Megan saw a little girl that was in second grade and kind of wanted to make friends right there in the restaurant. So they're excited to settle in and have some friends. Megan is seven. She'll be eight coming up this spring, and Michelle is, let's see if I take off my shoes. Let me put it this way. When we got married, Michelle was 27, and we were playing softball one day with the church league, and we were out in the game, and we wanted a few beers after the game. We sent her out for the beer, and they carded her, and I don't think she didn't have her purse with her, and they couldn't buy the beer, and they sent her back without it. So I married a very young-looking bride, and I'm the only one that ages in the family. I also like to thank the church, if I'm not redundant, for the basket. The welcome basket to us that we received. It had some buffalo coffee mugs in it, and one for us and one for the buffalo. And it had buffalo sausage in it. I didn't know they had all these things. So I guess that makes it right at home. We'll hang the buffalo and we'll toast. Be all together. We saw the Trebigs down in Lubbock. Seems funny to me to come up here and see the Trebigs and then to go down to Lubbock and see the Trebigs. And we had the 25th anniversary celebration while I was back for the Lubbock congregation. 25 years, and so he spoke, and I got to sit back and relax and enjoy the service, something I truly enjoy, so it was nice. We kind of had a big celebration done on that end and said goodbye to everybody again. I've said goodbye so many times, I almost feel like I wore out my welcome, hugs and everything, so it was pleasant. But anyway, we're on the road. Our furniture, we figure, is somewhere between here and Boise in a snowbank. We don't know for sure. They couldn't find the truck, so the truck's out there, but I'm sure it's on its way. They expect the furniture to be unloaded tomorrow. We were kind of glad the furniture wasn't unloaded Friday because it was raining, and we were told that the five-day forecast was clear and dry. So far, hasn't worked. Got up this morning to the snow and slid down the hill on our way out of town, but it was I'm expecting the forecast to kick in for Monday. We had a pleasant trip up. We didn't know exactly what we'd be running into with the winter, so every night we would watch the TV and get the weather channel and see what our course would be, because there's any three or four different ways we could have come. So we'd plan our route day by day and see which way the front was moving across the north to see when we would cross the top of Idaho. And we got to Pueblo going up through Colorado, and the weather forecast showed a large high-volume wind tunnel basically from there on up to Billings, and so we decided to cut to the west. And we went through Royal Gorge. Anybody here gone through Royal Gorge? They have tame deer there, in case you're hunters. You can go in there. You don't have to shoot them. You could walk up and just knock them over the head. I've got pictures of Megan and Derek with a whole group of, heard a little group of deer there, three or four at a time, petting the deer smiling for the camera. Big bucks, you know, six or bigger, I forget. I didn't stop and count. They were waving their head, and big bucks there feeding them out of our hands, feeding them apples, and it was an amazing thing. As we came across Colorado, there was literally hundreds and hundreds of deer and elk bedded down in the fields and the hillsides along the roadway, come down out of the mountains to mooch off of the farmer's grass. And when we went by Wisdom, Montana, we went by in the night, but The next morning, the hotel clerk said there was a herd of 500 elk had come down out of the mountains and had congregated in a farmer's field. And of course, he's down there with his gun by the haystack trying to survive for the winter, but 500 elk all come down together in one spot. So it was a pleasant trip. I feel like God blessed us in spite of me. We were coming through Colorado, and Michelle says, "What's that noise?" I kind of listen. You can hear this kind of a. Well, you know how a hubcap sounds sometimes when it's a little bit loose, and you go by a building and you hear this echo off the building. Well, it sounded like that. And I said, "Well, honey, that's just hubcaps a little loose or something. It's whining a little bit back there." So I said, "Don't worry about it." Of course, we're out in the wilderness of Colorado. We drove all day long and into the night till we stayed. And in the morning, that's amazing. After I tightened that hubcap, it still made that same noise. So I took it over to a tire dealership and had him check it, and he pulled the tire off, and the wheel bearings just fell out in pieces. And he said, 50 more miles, and you'd have been on the roadside. So, you know, Michelle is very confident now in my abilities to diagnose problems with a car. God was merciful anyway, even though I ignored this, and we were able to actually fix it where we stayed, and we were off and on the road, so trip up here went well. As the truck was loaded, the moving crew came in and packed everything up, put it all on the truck. It's interesting. Each time we move, the load on the truck is just a little bit further down toward the back from where we were before. Each time it seems we've picked up a couple of items, but they loaded the truck. Everything was on it except what we carried ourselves, and they closed the doors and the truck drove away. And you know, Michelle and I were outside watching that and the kids, and Michelle said, you know, she felt kind of strange. She felt strange because here goes everything that we have accumulated in this life, all packaged up on one truck, and it's rolling off down the road out of sight. Now, it's not like we don't believe it's going to arrive up here as well, but, you know, it's an amazing thing, things that you've collected and household items, items from the family, you know, heirlooms and everything all in one big box rolling down the road. I can remember when I could take everything I owned in this life, every single stitch of things that I owned in this life, and I could put it in the back seat in the trunk of a Camaro. And I did one time. I left home, I packed up everything I owned and drove away across country and went to work down in Tennessee. From the Camaro, somehow or other, we've grown. Each time we stop, we pick up a few more items, fill up one more room, gather a few more trinkets from the family and put it together. We've often talked, well, if there was a fire or if there was some kind of emergency, as you ran out of the house, what would you take? I've often thought about the computer disks I've got. You know, all of my studies, my sermons, my research is on there. Michelle figures we ought to at least go first for the kids. Pictures on the walls, pictures of mom and dad when they first married, things that can't be replaced, things for which there is no way to buy another one. Some of those things you wonder. I think it's important from time to time that we pause and evaluate what really is important in this life, what's the most important to us. A few years back from Lubbock, I was headed to Roswell. Roswell was the sister church on circuit. It was 175 miles away and out across the desert there. And as I was headed out of Lubbock down the road, maybe 10 miles, I passed a man. I estimate him about 60 years old, walking south on the highway. A traveler just walking south. Now, you know what a hitchhiker looks like, right? If he's walking along the road, his thumb's in the air, or maybe he's looking over his shoulder, catches your eye, he wants to make you feel guilty. We passed a hitchhiker on the way up that actually looked at me and went like this. Now, I don't know how he knew I was a minister, but that somehow he looked at me like, that would do it. That'll break him down. He'll pick us. I just blew him right on by because I've got blankets and airbed and boxes and I got everything the truck couldn't hold left in my van, and so there wasn't room. We couldn't have picked up a chipmunk, I don't think, coming up here. But anyway, I left the guy praying on the side of the road. I knew God would answer his prayers. But there was a man, about 60, and he wasn't looking back. He didn't have his thumb in the air. He's just walking down the road, and I just couldn't stand it. I stopped. And I said, "Would you like a ride?" And he walks over to the car, and he thanked me, and he got in the van very slow. you know, just kind of play. I had a van at that time, and he puts his foot up and kind of slides and pushes himself up into the chair. Now, except for the clothes that he had on his back, all he had with him was a very light windbreaker jacket and, you know, a supermarket plastic bag, the kind you get your groceries in. And in the plastic bag, he had a spare pair of shoes. And they were soft-soled, and he said when his feet got tired, he would change to the other shoes and just give himself a break. Now, that is all that he was carrying. He wasn't shaved that morning. You know how it looks when you've got a full head of hair and the guy combs it with his fingers? He just kind of goes back like that, and there's these lines go back through his hair because he didn't have a brush, and he wasn't even carrying, in that sense, he wasn't even carrying a comb. Overall, he's relatively clean, but he was a strange individual to try to perceive and try to understand. As he was getting in the car, he apologized for being so slow. He said he had a bad back, and he said that he had spent the night just up the road there in Lubbock, where he had just sold his car. And so now he was on foot walking down the highway. I asked him where he was from. He said he was from Florida. He said he'd lost his job. He said he'd never been west of the Mississippi. That he didn't really have that many years left, he figured, in his life, and he wanted to see what he could, and he hoped that in the process he could find something to do. Now here's a man that had sold off what was left of anything he owned back in Florida. Family, I don't remember exactly what had happened, but there was some separation in the family. He had his apartment, he had what little belongings were left. I mean, he didn't carry so much as a picture with him. He carried a windbreaker jacket. He carried the money, his life earnings, whatever was left of the value of his car in his pocket, and a spare pair of shoes, and that was everything that he owned in this life that remained. And he was walking down the road saying he hoped he could find something to do. He was pretty quiet, looked out the window. I thought I would, you know, I'm a minister, so I'm a jabberbox in part, you know. And I thought, well, I'm going to tell him about the area a little bit. I'll at least strike up a conversation, see what, maybe I can see what's inside there. So I told him about the history of the area, the panhandle of Texas. I told him how the buffalo hunters had first come out in that area and set up camps and traded with the Indians. And those buffalo camps became some of the cities, like Lubbock eventually. And then the railroads came in. The ranchers moved in. People like Charles Goodnight that came in with herds and rounded up the longhorns and set them out on pasture all through the grass in that area. I told him about some of the ranches and how big they were. There's a ranch up there that they called the XIT. I don't know if any of you are cowboy history buffs, but the XIT, X is 10, IT is in Texas. The ranch was called 10 in Texas, XIT. It was 10 counties big. Now, 10 counties there is the same as a county here, approximately, I think. And so I think the ranch was 150 or 60 miles tall, north to south, 60, 80, 90, I don't remember exactly wide. It was counties more to the north. That was one ranch. When I lived in New Mexico before I went to Ambassador College, the man's ranch I stayed on counted his property in sections, not in acres. And his father's ranch was next to his, and his ranch was counted in sections, not in acres. And his father had worked on the XIT ranch as a cowhand and came out and homesteaded property in New Mexico with a wagon and hauled it out there. And I always wondered, where was this ranch? And then when I lived in Lubbock, we found out a little bit about the history of the area. So I'm explaining the area and a little bit about the history of Texas to this man. And, you know, he didn't say much. He commented a little bit from time to time, never complained. Didn't make any requests, and eventually he said, well, what do you do? I said, well, I'm a minister. He said, well, there'll be sure plenty of need for that. It's going to take a lot of faith. Now I thought, well, what is he saying? Well, yeah, there's plenty of need for a minister. I could understand that. It'll take a lot of faith. And I thought, you know, look at this man. Everything he owns in this life is in his pocket, and not much of that. He has nowhere to go. I asked him where he was headed, and he's just headed down the road. And he had nowhere particularly to go, but he just was going to see what was there, and he hoped he would have something to do. He was saying, when you have nothing to support yourself, and you don't have family to rely on, and you have nowhere to go, it takes a lot of faith. If you strip this life off, take away the possessions, the fancy cars, the nice homes, the clothing, all of the luxuries that we have, take away the fridge, the freezer, and throw them out, it'll take a lot of faith. Because you have nothing left but what? You have nothing left but your relationship to God. and whatever relationships you are able to build with man. If we stripped ourselves down to just an extra pair of shoes and walked out the door, I guess that would take a lot of faith. And I took it that that's what he meant, that's what he was saying. In Luke chapter 12, verse number 22, this is just after the parable of the rich fool. The person who had these barns that he built in order to take care of all of his goods, and his security was in the fact that he could always go get what he wanted out of the barn, and that was his security. And then after that comes this passage that talks about, look, let's not worry. Let's not worry about these things. Christ told his disciples, he says, don't worry about your life, what you're going to eat, or your body, what you're going to put on. Life is more than that. Life is more than what you eat, and it's more than what you wear. And he says, well, look at the birds. And look at the fact that God has designed a system where they are provided for. Look at the flowers. God has designed a system where they survive, they exist in great glory, greater than Solomon's glory. Solomon had a lot of glory. I mean, incredible. Can you imagine his walk-in closet? How many pairs of shoes you think he had? How many coats, cloaks? How many, you know, Ray-Ban sunglasses were on his shelf? He probably had dozens and dozens of everything you could ever imagine, and things that he never even tried on or wore. We, from time to time, most of the time, have bought things like through a garage sale or somebody that we knew that was selling some clothes, or like for the kids or something. And from time to time, we have purchased things that have never, ever, ever been used. Somebody had enough resource that they could buy it new, set it on the shelf, outgrow it before they touched it, and then sell it. I like those kind of people. They're my kind of people. But we don't do that. When we get done, you can't even use it for compost. But Christ here is trying to explain that, you know, there's more to life than our possessions, than our comfort, than our very nice things, which are good to have. He says, and what good does it do for you to worry? Which of you, by worrying, can add one cubit to his stature? You know, we do. We struggle and worry. I worry. But it doesn't really change the circumstance. It says, if you're not able then to do the least, why are you anxious for the rest? Verse 28, if God then clothes the grass, because he talks about the lilies and their glory, which today's in the field, tomorrow's thrown into the oven, how much more will he clothe you, O you of little faith? He's contrasting those who are looking to the possessions, the contacts, the relationship in terms of having a place to go, a place to stay. It was guaranteed and secured, and that was where their faith was. And he said, you have little faith because you don't have faith in God. If you walk out the door with a pair of shoes, you're going to take a lot of faith because you're going to have to trust God to make provision. It's easy to have faith when you can make provision for yourself. So as I dropped this man off, I offered him a few dollars. He said, I don't need it. I just sold my car. I gave it to him anyway. His car, he didn't have much. But he was asking for nothing. And I dropped him off, and I headed down west toward Roswell, and he continued on down the highway, down toward the freeway where there'd be more rides. You know, it was an incredible thing. I asked God as I drove across to deal kindly with him. Here's a man that I had never met before. I rode in his car, or he rode in my car, for a few minutes, and yet he impacted my life because it made me stop and think, what indeed would life be if you took it all away? What would really be left, and what is important? What is the most important thing then that remains? I love to backpack. I haven't done it a whole lot, not lately. Backpacking in the panhandle of Texas just isn't that great. Backpacking in Nebraska on the plains wasn't that great either. You could travel all day long and you could see where you left when you began. You could look back and see the starting point. But I understand up here, at least from the travels I've had and living in the Northwest, you know, there's some remarkable wilderness and some access up here that I look forward to getting up in, taking the children up in, letting them camp, see what it's like to be out in the open. One of the things I like about backpacking is you get rid of everything you own effectively. Your house now is back again on your back. And it changes your perspective. It changes the way you look at a shower. It changes the way you look at water running out of your sink. changes the way you look at the road in front of your house, potholes or not, okay? It changes, it brings you back to reality to say, look, all of this that we have is luxury, it's opportunity, it is great blessing, and it brings you back, it does to me, it brings me back a little to perspective, to know what that mattress really does feel like and how nice it is. I want my kids to know that. I want them to understand that what they have is luxury and great blessing. What if you took all of that away? Can you imagine if you walked out of your house with everything you owned on your back? You know, my buffalo head would depreciate pretty quickly. I mean, some things that we enjoy just wouldn't be worth a thing on the road. Just wouldn't be worth a thing. Some of this area was settled by people who came out from the east and covered wagons. Oregon Trail runs right there up by the Columbia River, ran across, and people who came up on the Oregon Trail filtered down into the Willamette Valley, and they filtered up as well, I'm sure, into some of this area as well. You know, I've lived along that trail in Nebraska. When we lived in Boise, there was a place where there was a cut down the side of the hill down to the river where you could still see the track marks, the grooves where the wagons went through. Part of the trail went right through there, right through the town. And so there were people that came out on that trail and covered wagons, and they started the journey with those things that were most important to them, their treasures, and they put them in the back of their wagons, and they started out across. And the first time they came to a long, hard climb, they had to make some hard decisions. And maybe that little organ they had thrown in the back of the wagon had to be set out on the side of the road, and on they went. Or maybe some of the treasures that they had packed in the back had to be set aside as well. And every time they came to the next hill, or if they lost an ox or two, or if they reduced their ability to pull their transport behind them, they had to make some hard decisions. What can I leave now? What must I keep with me as I go? And they found out that some of the things that they thought were so important were not as important after all, because they were left on the side of the trail, never to be resolved or picked up or reused again. It's an incredible thing to stop and realize, just making those kinds of decisions. I read a story once in an article that had a picture on the front. The picture on the front was an old sod house, and it was out on the plains in Nebraska. And on the front of the sod house, there was a bird cage, and inside the cage was a canary. And the story was about the woman who had come out with her family, her husband, and settled out there on the plains, and how they cut that house out of the sod and built it themselves, and yet they were all alone in the desert, not the desert, the plains there, I'm thinking Texas, but the plains would just recede to the horizon, and it was just grass, rolling grass. And there weren't any trees, or there weren't any, you know, pack and saves. There was nothing out there, just this sod hut that they built, and the fields that they cut out of that grass as well. And it showed how that woman lived there for a time, and as they were able to hold on to their property and the things they built and the corrals and the pens. And then it talked about how as they moved off of the prairie into town, and then they ended up with a smaller house, and as she got older, and then her husband died and her family was gone, and then pretty soon she was in a rest home. And it showed how she reduced her possessions each step of the way. And finally, when she died, they went into her room, and she had in a little box everything that she now valued in this life. You know, everything I value in this life is in 3/4 of a moving van. Thankfully, hope to have 7/8 of one when I leave. But everything she had and what I someday will have, you can put it in a box. And I know that. What do you think was in the box? Gold bullion? You know, what was in the box were a few letters, special treasured letters from her family over the years, letters that were particularly meaningful because of the timing and what was addressed, and a canary, an old dried out canary wrapped in a handkerchief, folded up and maintained in a box. Those were the most precious things that she had in this life. When you sorted through the furniture and you sorted through the possessions and everything else, she got down to this one box. I think the letters we can understand. The letters were treasured mementos of relationships that she had maintained. The bird, I think we can understand the bird as well. When she was on the prairie, and she was all alone, and she didn't have anyone, that canary was life, it was hope. There was a song, there was beauty, there was encouragement. And she treasured that bird because it gave her something to hope for and beauty. It brought some beauty into her life. And she carried that canary again in her box with her letters until she died. She kept to her death what had helped her to be strong. She kept those things that helped her to endure trial and test. Our possessions and what I have in that truck and what we have in that truck really isn't going to help me be strong or to endure at all. Those are just not going to be my most treasured possessions. It's easy to lose perspective about what's really important in this life. So much of what we sometimes value so highly is very temporary, very much in passing. I have a book, Knave's Topical Bible, which is a reference work. Many of you are familiar with it. This life in the Bible is described by the word vanity. Now, the word vanity in the Old Testament is different than the way we use it today, but it's related. It's not exactly the same. Vanity there means kind of fleshly. It means temporary. It means it's only here for a while, and it's gone, and it really doesn't have permanent value. Therefore, it's kind of vanity. And that's where the English word came from, out of that. Now, I looked up some of the scriptures. I just marked them on this. It gives a list of scriptures, and these are mainly from Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes. But notice what it says in the Bible is vanity. Now, these are things, each one is a separate scripture. I'll just mention some of the subjects. Every man is vanity. Every state of man is vanity. Man at his best is vanity. The thoughts of man are vanity. The days of man, the childhood and the youth of man, the beauty of man. In fact, where you sit to check on the beauty and watch it fade is called a vanity. That's why. Man's own righteousness is vanity. Worldly wisdom, worldly pleasure, worldly anxiety, worldly labor. Well, what in this physical life isn't vanity? Nothing. It's all going to pass away. It's all going to be gone. Worldly enjoyment, worldly possessions, heaping up riches, love of riches, riches gotten by falsehood. And then it says, all earthly things are vanity. Temporary. They're on their way out. Enjoy them while they're here. Be glad you've got them, but keep it in perspective. When it's all said and done, you can take the treasures of this life and put them in a box. A little tiny box, most likely, in terms of the physical flesh. What's really important in this life is the relationships that we maintain. First of all, it's our relationship with God, and secondarily, it's our relationship with man. If we could look at this life stripped down with just the clothes on our backs, if we could look at life in its simplest form, I believe that's what we would see. Now, obviously, God, our relationship with God, is the most important thing that we have. It's easy to say. We know the answer to that. But it doesn't mean we always put God first. You ever been down, kneeling, trying to pray, and the phone rings? What do? We answer the phone. We don't want to interrupt somebody trying to get through on the phone, because God doesn't mind. We do it anyway. What do you do if somebody comes to the door? You get the door. How many times in life are we in the process of trying to build our relationship to God and something comes along and interrupts and we allow indeed such an interruption to intercede on our relationship with God? The issue is not prayer. The issue is the fact that God is the most important relationship that we have in this life, and we allow many different things in 1,000 different ways to interrupt that. Sometimes we need to just effectively let the phone ring. All of the physical pursuits and problems of this life, all of the vanity of this life, are in constant competition with our relationship to God, and we need to keep them in their proper place. We need to keep them in their place. We are so often driven by circumstances. We need more often, frankly, to choose those things which are right and good and pure regardless of the circumstances. We need to be more proactive in the way that we approach our lives at times. James 4 is a passage that is absolutely fundamental in terms of perspective in this life, what our responsibility is, what our options are. James 4 and verse number 7, it talks about being patient and persevering, and what does it take to make you strong? What is it going to take that's of most essential value to get you through trial and test and go on? It says, be patient, brethren, until the coming of the Lord. It says, see how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, waiting patiently for it until he receives the early and latter rain. You also be patient. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. That's James 5. Sound good? Isn't that great? You can work in anything you want. You just keep reading, and then you have to be honest and say, oops, James 4. Wish I had said 5, and then I could say 4, and then you'd think of James 4. Therefore, submit to God. This is a better principle anyway. Therefore, submit to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Now, the most important relationship in this life we have is God, and indeed, the Bible says if we draw near to him, he'll be responsive to that. He will draw near to us. If we push ourselves away from Satan, he actually gets pushed away. And God intercedes in that process on our behalf. We need to get close to God and stand in his presence, and we need to move away from the vanity, from the temptation, from anything that intercedes in that relationship, whatever that would be. Psalm 51. David fights a battle here. David fights a battle with the fact that he's been stripped down to just effectively the clothes on his back. And maybe in David's mind, he was laying prostrate before God in a way that he had absolutely nothing. David is a great king. He's got a castle or whatever he had to live in, a big temple that he had there while he was saving to build, and he had the money to set aside for that. He had an army, he had a nation, he was king, he had any woman he wanted, basically, you know, within a certain amount of limit there. And David had all these big options. I mean, I don't know how many tractor trailers and trucks you would have put his possessions in, but it wasn't like he was running short. And yet here, he's stripped down with everything gone to the clothes on his back, effectively, looking at life in its most essential form. And he says in verse number 10, create in me a clean heart, O God, and renew a steadfast spirit within me. Do not cast me away from your presence, and do not take your Holy Spirit away from me. He says, I want the relationship back. I want my contact with you back. I want your spirit, and I don't want to lose that. He's not asking for the country. He's not asking for the big fancy house. He's not asking for the castle or the army. He's asking for the heart and core of what was there. And he said, restore to me the joy of your salvation and uphold me with your generous spirit. He says, if you do that, he said, then I can be of some use to you again. I can be of value to you. Then I will teach transgressors your ways, and sinners will be converted to you. If I can be restored to you, then maybe through me others will be restored as well. He didn't say, well, then the land can be prosperous, and we can all have fruit and goods in abundance, and we can go shopping every day at the mall. He says, if I can be close to you, I can serve you again. That's life stripped down to its heart and core, to its fundamentals. If all you had was a clothes on your back and a spare pair of shoes, you could still stay close to God. But you know what? It might take a lot of faith. It might take a lot of faith, but you could still stay close to God. What's really important in this life after God? How about our families? Family is very high on our list of priorities. It must be. And even within the family, there has to be a list of priorities as well. First priority is the relationship of the husband and the wife, and the second priority then comes the relationship with the children. The relationship with the children cannot be placed over the relationship with the husband and the wife, because that is what gives the opportunity to nurture and to protect and to guide those children. Now, there are catastrophes and there are indeed disasters but we must not participate in them or create them. The foundation of the marriage must be put first. Just like our relationship with God must come first, the relationship with the parents must come first, so that out of that will then proceed, as is Abel, a blessing for the children at hand. Deuteronomy 24. Verse number 5 talks about building a foundation in principle. It says, when a man has taken a new wife, he shall not go out to war or be charged with any business. He shall be free at home 1 year and bring happiness to his wife whom he has taken. Now, it doesn't say that after you get married, the man doesn't have to work for a year, although that really sounds like a good idea. It just says that the man has to focus on the marriage, and you can't afford to be gone for a year off at war where you might get killed or maimed. You can't afford to be starting up some enormous business that's going to take every bit of your energy away from the marriage itself. Build the foundation first. Build the relationship first. Make her happy first. And then take on the additional responsibilities, the vanities of this life. Then go ahead and build your barn and your house and all of the things that we would like to have and accomplish and enjoy. There's nothing wrong with those rightly enjoyed, but make sure the relationship is established first. You have to make your investment before you get to collect the dividends. That's what it's saying. Sometimes I sit down with someone who's having very serious marriage difficulties. Frustration and anger, bitterness and strife, and all of the complex issues that then arise, and the emotions and the problems that exist. You know what that makes me want to do? It makes me want to go home and hug Michelle. Not necessarily because we had such a good day. We might not have had a good day at all. Just want you to know, once in a while, Michelle and I don't have good days. I know everybody here all has good days. But even if the day was not a good day, it makes me want to go home and see if I can't make a contribution in some way that might indeed end it as a good day because of what I have just again experienced. It convicts me to try to do whatever I can to contribute toward the solution in that case. And at that time, again, when I see all of the anger and the frustration and the bitterness and the strife and the impact on the children and the frustration and the problems emotionally and the sickness that comes as a result oftentimes, when I see all of that, it's amazing how the frustrations that I have at times in our own circumstances seem to, at that point, kind of melt away. It simply reduces them in my own mind and reinforces the contribution, indeed, that I need to have. I think many of you over the years, I would expect, have probably read letters to Philip or letters to Karen. They're very basic books written a long time ago. Charlie Shedd, he wrote one to, I think, his daughter, one to his son-in-law, or vice versa, whichever it was. And it was fatherly advice to the children in their preparation for marriage. And I want to just read you one of those letters. In regard to relationships, this is a letter on letters to Philip. And it's entitled, The Man Who Had a Thing About Guns. It says, Dear Phil, I used to hunt ducks with a man who had a thing about his guns. He also had a thing about my gun. He polished his with some special kind of oil that smelled like bananas. And then he ate me out in the blind whenever the ducks weren't flying because my gun didn't smell like bananas. In fact, my gun even had some scratches on the brown part. It also had some terrible stuff called pitting in the barrel. He said that was because I didn't clean it first thing when I got home after a hunt. But there were some good reasons why I kept hunting with this firearm perfectionist. He was a member of the best duck lease on the river, and I wasn't. He was also chairman of the board at our church, and we could talk business to and fro. And the third reason, though, wasn't quite as good. Really wasn't that good at all. He was having trouble with his wife, and I hoped that we might be able to save the marriage, but we couldn't. Finally, she gave up. They got a divorce, and it was one of those cases that would make a grown man cry. There he would sit in his beautiful den full of antelope heads, stuffed pheasants, lush white rug made from the hide of a mountain goat, a cabinet full of beautiful guns, all polished with oil that smelled like bananas. And he would stand there by the case, taking them out, handling them with tender, loving care. And then he would remember the way my gun looked, and he'd take off again on one of his diatribes about the care of guns. This never failed to shame me, and I'd go home determined to get out my gun and clean it like it had never been cleaned before. You know what happened? When I arrived home, she'd be waiting for me at the door, and we'd sit down in the rocking love seat, hold hands, visit, you know, like that. And in less time than it takes to look into her eyes, I completely forgot my noble resolve to love my gun with more devotion. The other day, as I was thinking back on all of this, a great idea occurred to me. Funny, isn't it, how often we get these brilliant thoughts too late? What happened was that my banana oil brother would always include in his lectures at least one reference like this. I just can't understand how a man could invest so much in a gun and then let it go to pot. And the thought that came to me was, why didn't I figure out how much it cost him to get his wife? Courtship, expenses, movies, flowers, dinners, gifts, postage, the wedding, all the food she's eaten through the years, clothes she's bought, medicine, that'd be a tidy sum, wouldn't it? And then I could have said, my dear friend, you're absolutely right. Now let's turn your brilliant observation to other things. Isn't a man a fool to invest so much in marriage and then let it go to pot? He sure would be, wouldn't he? You know, it's an amazing thing when you think of how much we have invested in relationships, in our marriages, in our families, with our children. Isn't it a crazy thing to take a relationship in which we have invested so much and let it go to pot? Seems so. Our children would definitely benefit if we keep our priorities straight. God is reproducing himself through us and our children. We hold our children as custodians for God. They're his children that he has granted to us. And we think of them as ours, indeed they are, but we are custodians to turn our children to God. Yes, they have to ultimately make the choice, but we are there to make that choice, if it is possible for them, a little easier, to make it a little more desirable, a little more precious and valuable to them. But it is so easy for us to become so busy with all of our vanity and all of our possessions and all of our dreams and desires and all of our hopes and all of our opportunities that we set them aside in ways that we never even maybe really focused on or understood. I mentioned to you when I was speaking last time about my son and how the reconciliation of that came about. I want to share with you today a letter that I got from his mom just a few weeks, maybe 3 weeks after we had met. We met in Oregon, and you see, my life was kind of full. We're in Oregon, I'm visiting my mom, I'm visiting him, and we're visiting friends, and then we went on up to Montana and spent some time vacation in Montana at a relative's home there that we had access to. And so, you know, now our time is filled there, and there's trout stream there on the property, and it's beautiful, and we can relax, and Michelle's out in the grass painting the scenery of the mountains. And then there's travel all the way back to Nebraska at that time. And of course, as soon as I get back, I've got my job to catch up. And so, you know, 2-3 weeks passed, and I was really busy, and life was full, and I got this letter. And it says, Mark, I'm writing you because I'm concerned that Brad hasn't heard from you since you were here. You know, I had reached out and established a relationship, and a relationship for me that only a very short blink of time had passed because my life was busy, but a relationship for Brad that he'd seen his father for the first time in his life, and then in 3 weeks there was no more contact. He says, I want to tell you something about Brad and why I'm concerned. Brad was very close to my first husband and has always considered him his father, even though I told him about you when he was 9. When Larry remarried, Brad wasn't allowed at their house, and I watched as Brad was treated like a stranger. I know a lot of these findings were my fault. I feel badly, but when I remarried, Brad was 12. He was still young enough to call Bill his dad, which he did on his own. Drugs, fear, abuse became part of our lives, and I finally, after 2 years, got us out of that. But Brad had lost another dad. You are Brad's real dad, and he's always wondered why you never cared, or at least never showed him that you did. I know firsthand how empty life is when you feel your father doesn't care. Her father basically just set her aside and let her go. There was no real contact. There was no family left on her side. He said, I just want to spare Brad any more hurt. He may be too old to ever call you dad. I'm not sure if you even want that. This is years ago, 8 or 9. our opportunity to restore has been wonderful and I believe complete. He does call me Dad and I call him Son, and we have a very strong and positive relationship. So it's up to you, Mark, not to let him down now that you have made the move. I will tell you, Brad is very proud and he'll never ask you for anything. He's walking down the street, so to speak, without his thumb in the air, not looking over his shoulder, but he'd really be happy if you stopped and gave him a ride. He's very proud. He'll never ask you for anything. But more than anything, he needs to know that you care about him. It takes a lot, as I have four kids, and always try to make them know that I am thinking of them. Brad is a great kid. You can be proud. Jeannie. You know, how long do you think it took me to get to the phone after I got the letter? 2 days? Week? About 15 seconds. I mean, if you got a letter like that, wouldn't you go and say, "Hello, how you doing, son? It sure was nice to be together with you. I'm looking forward to getting together again. I really hope we can build a relationship that maybe apparently we both desire." Brad wanted the relationship. His mom was concerned that somehow or another that had been offered and then not procured, not followed through. Relationships are really important. We can get busy. We can fill our time with our jobs and pursuits. I knew a man once whose son, he was a gunsmith, whose son deeply desired to learn gunsmithing, but the man was so busy, and this was a man in the church, he was so busy with his occupation that he didn't have time to teach his son what he did, or to show him, or to work with him. And the son absolutely craved attention, and it was a tragic thing to see. Craved attention, and it wasn't there, it wasn't even offered. Proverbs 13 and verse 22. A good man, this is just a point of wisdom, it doesn't even say a righteous man, it just says a good man. A good man is a person who chooses to do good things, whether he's converted or not. This is what we would call a good person. A good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children. You know, in the vanity of this life, we would process that maybe, well, I'll go ahead and set some money aside, not only for my children, but I'll set some aside for their children as well. And they'll have a little nest egg. And it's amazing. Rochelle's mom and dad absolutely believe this. And they, from time to time, give us little bits of money to set aside for Megan and Derek, and we put it in a little account, we save it for them, and they're actually moving little bits down. I mean, they don't have big resource, they live in a trailer, but they're still taking a portion for those kids, and it's something they absolutely believe in. Now, let's go beyond, again, the physical. Physical's important, but not the ultimate lesson. What would you really like to leave your grandchildren? How about stability? How about a relationship? How about leaving your grandchildren a mom and dad that are in a position, because of the relationship you have with them, to be a better mom and dad for them? How would you like to pass on a blessing through the family for generation after generation because you contributed to unity and to harmony and to peace in your family, and your children grow up that way and learn to do the same? Now that's worth more than a bank account. If you strip life down to the shirt on your back, then relationships are all you're going to have left. And the most important thing we can pass on to our kids is a family unit, to the degree we have ability and option to make contribution to that, and in personal relationship with them ourselves. Unconditional love isn't for sale. You can't buy it. You can't get a box of it and distribute it around. You have to administer it yourself. You can't buy back the time. I have a full-time job, just like you have a full-time job. We're all on an even scale. We all work as hard as we can work, and that's as hard as it goes. Nobody can work harder than that. You give it everything you've got. And yet I still have the obligation to remember in time and in proper time my children and to meet their needs. You can't buy that back. You can't do it over. One of the real incentives that Michelle's mom has is because when Michelle was growing up, her mom and dad were so busy making their living and trying to start some investments and do some other things, all of which was lost over time eventually. I'm not saying don't do that. I'm just saying, in perspective, let's keep this in place. But everybody was working, and Michelle and her brother Don were effectively raised in a daycare during the daytime. And there were so many things that Grandma looks back that she never got to do. And it drives them to try to do those things now for Megan and Derek. And it's an incredible thing. It's a process. But I've heard her remark on that. I mean, she carries with her to this day a burden of what she felt her obligation ultimately should have been, and the time that she really never had the time to spend. And I've heard her lament it many, many times. Children learn stability by experiencing stability, not by hearing about it. We are reproducing ourselves in those children as well. You get ready for marriage, and you look at the mate that you're preparing to marry, and I guarantee you, you're looking at your future children as well. Because if there's something about your future mate that you absolutely can't stand, wait till you got four more kids doing the same thing. That's how it works. That's absolutely how it works. Children learn stability because they've experienced it, not because they heard about it. They learn to share because you taught them to share. They learn to control their emotions because you have contributed toward their learning to control their emotions. They learn to be an honorable citizen in a community the very same way. When that structure breaks down, it puts life at risk. Everything we do and everything we say is an example for our children, but it needs to be the type of example that we want them to have, not the type of example that they receive by default. Whatever the example is, it will be set. We went down this morning to stopped at the Burger King just before you get to church in Kennewick on the right there, because we told them we could get them some breakfast, and they said, fine. Well, breakfast is something we need quick. We're short to getting into church, and I waited in the car tinkering with my notes, and the family never came back out, it seemed like. 15 minutes or more passed, and I finally went in to see what had happened. When Michelle went up to the counter to order them a biscuit with an egg in it, she says, well, you want a bit, whatever they call it. And the kids went, oh, gross. And so she ordered them chicken nuggets, and that takes time to cook, and so it was kind of slow. And I said, what do you mean, gross? Why wouldn't they eat a biscuit with an egg in it? She says, well, you won't eat it. Just before we left on the trip, truck's gone, no furniture, no silverware, nothing. We're going to eat out of the Burger King. And Michelle says, well, let's go just get some biscuits with an egg in them. And I said, oh, gross. Well, it is gross. A few weeks ago, Derek walked up to me and said, why is President Clinton such a bad man? I said, Derek, what are you saying that for? Well, that's what you say. Now, I'm sorry. I'm ashamed to have to admit that at times when he's come on the TV and in the back of the room, I'm bouncing off the walls because of what's being said. Sorry to offend the Democrats in our midst, but what it reminds me is, again, we're reproducing ourselves. And they're listening to everything we say. And they're going to be just like us. And we know that. And we know we can say that. But we have to make sure what's being reproduced is what we want. Megan, sometimes, she gave me permission to use this example. I'll never embarrass my family in public. Privately, sometimes. Never in public. Sometimes when Megan is acting up a bit, and Michelle has kind of gone to her and tried to make correction on that, and Megan can make an excuse, and she'll say, well, you know, I don't feel good. And, you know, Michelle was saying, you know, that's amazing. She said, it was like, you know, kind of ring a bell. Because when Michelle didn't, you know, is impatient and frustrated or nervous or something intense, and the kids want something, and she's trying to explain to the children why she's being nervous and impatient and tense. And she said, you know, I told the kids, I don't feel good. She tells them she doesn't feel good, and then the kids can understand why she's nervous and impatient and tense. So Megan figured, well, if that's how it works, then when she's causing a problem or something and we get on her, she said, well, look, I don't feel good. You know, don't have such high expectations of me. I don't feel good today. And you do. You hear yourself. There's echoes running through the family, running through the kids. And it's an incredible thing when you begin to listen to yourself come back. When you begin to hear yourself come back and your children. What is really important in this life? How about the rest of the relationships that we maintain? What is the basis of all the law, of all of God's Word in the Bible? What are the basic points? First point is you love God with all your heart, mind, and soul. And the second point is to love your neighbor as yourself. Under the commandments, under all the principles, under all the statutes and the judgments, under all of the Bible record, there are two points. And what are they? One is to have a good relationship with God and to have a good relationship with your fellow man. That is the basis of the Bible record. That's what it states. The basis of all the law. 1 John 4. As much as it lies within you, maybe it doesn't all lie within you, but as much as it does, you make contribution in a positive way as a good light. 1 John 4, verse number 7. Beloved, let us love one another, for love is of God, and everyone who loves is born of God and knows God. He who does not love does not know God, for God is love. It says, you know, if you connect on the first point, relationship to God, then there's going to be an automatic and immediate response, a necessary response on the second point. Verse 11, beloved, if God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. Because God has given us His Spirit, because He's living in us, because it is His nature, and because God's nature is love indeed, then we ought to respond in like manner. Verse number 20. If someone says, I love God, and hates his brother, he's a liar. For he does not love his brother whom he's seen, how can he love God whom he's not seen? And this commandment we have from him, that he who loves God must love his brother also. Must. Needs to. Important. A friend of mine in the church, one time after parents had died, there was an inheritance to be distributed among the children. And I think it was about $10,000 to go to each child. Now, that's a lot of change. You could buy a lot of comforts and convenience. You could go get yourself a CD. You could put it in the bank. You could have some security. You could do a lot of things with $10,000, even in the current economy. Well, the children began to squabble over the money because one had done this and one had done that and one had invested or helped or contributed in some way. And the kids began to fight and squabble over the money. And he just said, I will not fight my own family for this $10,000. And he told him to leave him out. He made his own living. He provided for his own family. $10,000 would have been handy, but not handy enough to destroy the relationship at home. And he just absolutely walked away and told the children to figure it out for themselves. Brethren, you can win the battle and lose the war. He could have garnered up his 10,000 and destroyed the relationships forever. And he said, it isn't worth it to me. I don't want to do that. He says, I will not participate in that way. What good is a local congregation if we are not able to congregate? What good does it do to either destroy the board or to hold on to the board if we destroy ourselves in the process? For what? What good purpose? Who here in the name of God is going to cast one more stone? In God's name, I am going to knock you with this rock. Who will do that? Bridges have to be built, not destroyed. Our neighbors in Lubbock, right across the street, were Jewish. We had talked to them, waved at them, had some superficial relationship there, but not really close or intimate or personal in that way, but over the years, I took special care of our yard. I guess that was my little hobby, and that's about the hobby I had, but, you know, I had a special mower, and you mow it real flat, and it looks like a little putting green. It's a special grass, and you scrape that dirt real flat, and then you lay the sod, and I mean, you could literally putt on the grass when you're done. It looks like a putting green. It's beautiful and always landscaped, and he used to look across the street at our yard, and he'd always say, man, I really enjoy looking out my window and seeing your landscaping on your yard. And he really liked that. He says, it's really pretty. And he was always grousing about his yard and how his grass didn't look like mine, and it wasn't the same. And so finally I said, well, look, you got to do it with this special mower because it cuts it in a certain way, and then you got to level it out and keep working with it, and then it flattens and it'll look nice. He said, well, would you mow my lawn? I said, mow your lawn? I said, like I got a job, like it's a big one. And I said, I'm happy. I don't need. He said, look, I'll pay you. I said, I don't need. Well, I didn't say I don't need the money. I don't think I've ever said that. I said, look, that's not the issue. He said, look, please, mow my lawn. He says, I said, look, I'll help you. I'll just mow it a couple times to get you started. I won't charge you. He says, I can't do that. I have to pay you. I said, okay, I'll mow your yard. Boy, he was happy. I mowed his yard every week in the summers, and he paid me, and we spent the money who knows what, you know. We got a little bit on it, but it was fine, and I mowed the lawn, and he became such a close personal friend because I was willing to mow his lawn and just contribute a little bit toward what he valued in that way. He was one of the men with the Jewish synagogue there, the temple as they would call it, I think it is, who had responsibility for the men who spoke, and the pastor left. He transferred out, and they hadn't replaced him. They had nobody actually pastoring, rabbiing, how do they call that? Nobody was rabbiing the temple. And so they were trying to get various people to speak on occasion there to the people. And we were at dinner before, when we told him we were leaving, he says, you've broken my heart. He said, you've ruined my day, my month, you've ruined my year, because we were just moving away. And I was astounded, and they took us out to dinner. And they paid for this big, beautiful meal and the drinks and whatever, and took us out at their cost, and sat there, and we talked all night and conversed. And he said, I was going to ask you to come speak to us. Now, I'm a Christian, and he's a Jew, and there's something we don't agree on. Just incidental, right? Something we don't agree on. And his congregation, of which he was part of the group there, but didn't have a pastor, and he was going to have me come and speak to him Friday night. He was going to ask me if I could go by and do that. I said, well, you know, I'd really be honored to be able to come speak to you. But I says, you know, there's no time. I'm gone. And he was really sorry that he hadn't asked sooner. But it was an amazing thing that a Jew would ask a Christian to come speak to the Jews because he liked and respected you as an individual and you were friends. And because there was a need that had to be filled in the interim until they could reestablish themselves with a pastor. Now, if I would have had opportunity to go, I've thought many times since, what would I have said? You know, I would have spoken to them as a Christian, but I would have spoken to them as Jews. I would have spoken to them in language that they would have recognized and understood as a courtesy and as a service, the same way that I would try to be of service to you as well. You know, my family and I are here to contribute in any way that we can. I really appreciate that. You know, I'll be honest. I mean, anybody here's children want to get up after coming across the United States and drive down to Kennewick for church and return, sit through two services? Young people, raise your hands. Well, mine didn't exactly want to do it either. So they're normal. But they did it. You know, cost me a bunch of bribes. No, I just threatened them. But they did it. And we want opportunity to do that. That man I dropped off on the road that day, going down to Brownfield, south of Lubbock, you know, as I said, I never even knew his name. I never thought to even ask him what his name was. You know, maybe he had a bad start in life. Maybe he was, as we would say, underprivileged, as if privilege is somehow a standard of which everybody deserves. Maybe he was somehow underprivileged. Maybe he had a great start and he threw it all away. Maybe he drank it up. Maybe he drove his wife and kids away from him. Maybe he did everything right but had a horrible run of bad luck. You know, maybe the tornado took the house and then the worms ate the foundation and maybe the car went in the ditch. I don't know. Maybe he just had a bad series of incidents and things that destroyed his resource. But you know what? At that point, it really didn't matter, did it? If he would have known just then in his life, with nothing but the shirt on his back, a coat, an extra pair of shoes, if he would have known to stop and put God ahead of everything else, then his life would not have been spent in vain. No matter what destruction, no matter what injury, no matter what pain, no matter what happened, his life would not have been spent in vain if he would have only known to be able to stop at that point in time and put God first. We know that. We have that key. And no matter what has happened to us, we can and should be and must be doing just that. If he only had 10% of what you and I can maybe even take for granted, spiritually, he would have thought himself a rich and prosperous man in this life before God. And if he'd only realized just how close he was to actually hearing about the kingdom of God that day, had there been opportunity or a chance, it would have been a wondrous thing to behold. Brethren, we sit here in the midst of those God has prepared for his kingdom. In that sense, we are that kingdom now, not in the way that it will be spiritually existing over the earth, but as where God is now ruling, we are there today. And we know these things. And we need to make sure that we are doing what is really important in this life. We need to take a lesson from the traveler.